Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. Russia says its forces are fighting an ongoing battle with saboteurs who crossed the border from Ukraine and carried out attacks in the Belgorod region. A 7-day ceasefire has come into effect in Sudan, but there are already reports of clashes in the capital, Khartoum. And the only black senator in the US Republican Party, Tim Scott, has announced he's running to be president, another challenger to Donald Trump. Also in this podcast:
greetings from outer space. I'm here not only representing myself, but representing the hopes and dreams of everyone back home.
Saudi Arabia's first woman in space among a crew that's docked with the International Space Station. And we begin in Belgorod on Russia's border with Ukraine. The blasts were from what appear to be attacks on targets in the region. A video has been posted on social media by the Liberty of Russia Legion, a militia which says it's working inside Russia to overthrow President Putin.
It's time to put an end to the Kremlin dictatorship. Thank you very much to all those who support us, who send us donations. Your support is what reminds us every day of our final goal, Red Square. Be brave and don't be afraid, because we are coming back home. Russia will be free.
The regional governor has said it was an attack by a sabotage group which was repelled by Russian forces. But the head of the Wagner military group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was rather dismissive of the Russian military's response.
As far as I know, the Russian military doesn't do a damn thing to strengthen our borders in the directions where the Ukrainian army can enter from. The ministry must do it. It is its direct responsibility. They aren't the Ministry of Offence, so they can't offend, but the Ministry of Defence, so they are obliged to defend the country.
Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been following developments.
There were reports of explosions and gunfire on the Russian side of the border with Ukraine, what seemed to be an attempt by a heavily armed unit or group to break into Russian territory from Ukraine. Later, the governor of Belgorod region, Vyacheslav Gladkov, put out a message in social media saying that a sabotage group, he claimed a Ukrainian sabotage reconnaissance group, had entered the territory of Belgorod region and that Russian security forces, the army, the National Guard, border guards, were working to, as he put it, liquidate the enemy. And there were unconfirmed reports that this sabotage group had artillery and tanks. Ukraine responded by saying this was not a Ukrainian attack. It said that these were Russian citizens who'd taken up arms, Russian paramilitary groups fighting on the side of Ukraine. And later, one of these groups that calls itself the Liberty of Russia Legion said, yes, it was doing the fighting, along with the so-called Russian Volunteer Corps. Now, there have been incursions before, but this is certainly, I think, one of the biggest attacks of its kind that we've seen since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine last year.
So what more can you tell us about these groups seemingly of Russian citizens who seem to have carried out this attack? What more do we know about them?
They're quite shady. I mean, I think the Liberty of Russia Legion, it is a Ukraine-based militia that says that it's working inside Russia for the overthrow of President Putin. It's actually been designated a terrorist organisation already, I think, by Russia. The Russian Volunteer Corps is also anti-Kremlin, and it seems to be run by far-right figures. But Ukraine says these are not part of the Ukrainian military, that these are Russian citizens who are sympathetic to Ukraine. But there's still a lot we don't know about what happened today, and as far as we know, the situation continues. The governor of Belgorod region, Governor Gladkov, he announced an anti-terrorist operation regime in Belgorod region. And that means there'll be tighter security in the region, more document checks for people. And it means that the authorities can evacuate citizens from certain areas if they need to.
And looking at the broader picture, Steve, this comes just days after Russia said it had taken Bakhmut after that months-long, very bloody battle. What does what happened in Belgorod tell us about how the war itself is progressing?
For a start, we talk about Bakhmut. Yes, the Russians say that they have taken the city. Ukraine says that's not the case. But I think what happened today in Belgorod region is embarrassing for the authorities, for the Kremlin. I mean, the Kremlin claims that one of the reasons it launched the so-called special military operation 15 months ago was for the sake of Russia's national security, in other words, to make Russians safer. But the reality is that 15 months ago, in Belgorod region and in other Russian regions that border Ukraine, life was calm and it was peaceful. And there were no sabotage groups forcing their way over the border from Ukraine. There were no drone attacks on Belgorod region, as there have been regularly since the Russian invasion in February 2022. The conclusion, then, is that the Russian invasion of Ukraine has not made Russians safer. Quite the opposite.
That was Steve Rosenberg. Next to Sudan and a seven-day ceasefire between the Sudanese army and the rival Rapid Support Forces militia was due to come into effect on Monday evening. However, as we record this podcast, there have already been indications it might not be observed. Earlier, the UN envoy to Sudan warned of a growing ethnic dimension to the war. Volker Perthes told a special meeting of the UN Security Council the conflict risked expanding with serious implications for the region. He also said those responsible for committing crimes against the Sudanese people must be prosecuted.
The fighting throughout the country has resulted in serious human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law and undermines the protection of civilians. These violations must be investigated and the perpetrators must be brought to justice.
Meanwhile, the fallout from the conflict in Sudan has left neighbouring South Sudan facing a humanitarian crisis. Almost 70,000 people have crossed into the country over the past month. South Sudan, already one of the world's poorest countries, is now faced with the challenge of looking after new arrivals and returning them to their homes. Our Africa correspondent Catherine Biarahanga reports.
Tempers are flaring, people are pushing and pulling as a small crowd of people try to push their way into the terminal here at Palloch Airport. But there are some soldiers and policemen right at the door. This is the only option they have in order to get to the capital, Juba, and other cities. The South Sudanese who've made it this far to Palloch Airport have been on an incredible journey to get home. Some of them have been camped out here for 2 weeks. Mumtush is sitting on an airport trolley, watching the crowd as she carries her stepson. They're among thousands of people, many of them South Sudanese, who have braved uncomfortable nights and the scorching sun for days, waiting to be airlifted.
We sleep on the floor. When we were asleep, our things were stolen, our bags, our bed sheets. Now we don't have anything. We just sleep on the floor. The situation is very hard.
This is a massive undertaking for South Sudan's government, trying to relocate tens of thousands of people arriving in just a few weeks. There were an estimated 3 million South Sudanese living in Sudan before the recent conflict. Many went there because of a civil war here in South Sudan. Sandy Manil is waiting by the airport gates with her five children. She has spent 2 weeks here.
They haven't told us when we will travel from here. You wait at the gate. It depends on your luck. Sometimes they take your ticket and they allow you in. Or they don't. Sometimes, even if you enter inside, they will still not take you. Tomorrow, after tomorrow, no one knows.
This is the moment everyone's been waiting for. The large white cargo plane that's meant to fly them to the capital, Juba, has arrived, and so hundreds of people are sat on the tarmac, patiently waiting to get onto this plane. We're told that this plane can only accommodate around 300 people, but in front of me, I can see more than 500. South Sudan's government, already struggling to support its people, is now overwhelmed with thousands returning home. It's organising daily flights from Paloch and has already airlifted more than 7,000 people from here. It has promised to prioritise women and children. Albina Akol is the Minister for Humanitarian Affairs.
It is difficult because the war is continuous and the people are continuing moving. This is why we always appeal to the international community, to UN agencies, to the donors, that they have to come in very quickly. Otherwise, we will actually witness another crisis.
In the nearby city of Renk, some are turning to the River Nile, which runs through South Sudan. That's the sound of a water pump in the background, drawing water from the River Nile. Docked right here is the Queen of Peace. It's a boat that's several meters long. It's being operated by the Catholic charity Caritas, and it's carried out at least three missions along the River Nile, taking people who fled from Sudan to the city of Malakal. Seated on a mat under a tree by the river is Proneka Kurador. She's one of those trying to get to Malakal, but the area is not completely secure and still sees bouts of violence.
I don't know if it's safe or not. I've been told that my house has been destroyed and the things have been stolen. If I go there and there is nothing, I will try to rebuild the house.
Proneka then says a prayer for herself and thousands of others dealing with the consequences of the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
Catherine Bjerahanga. Now, shortly before we came into the studio, President Biden and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, began what are being billed as crunch talks over raising the U.S. debt ceiling. If an extension can't be agreed, that could lead to the government defaulting, something which could wreak economic havoc both at home and in the wider world. The deadline is June the 1st. But in the run-up to the meeting, Mr. McCarthy told reporters that the current negotiations would be acceptable to the majority of his Republican lawmakers. Our business correspondent in New York is Michelle Fleury.
If you judge by the reaction here on Wall Street, you know, not far from where I'm talking to you, investors remain pretty calm at the moment. And the reason for that is because they see it as a manufactured problem, one that hopefully they presume will get solved, even if it is at the last minute. That being said, though, there is still the possibility of things going slightly awry, of this turning into a catastrophe. And I think you start to see that in corners of the financial markets. And in part, meanwhile, we're already hearing reports that the Treasury departments and other government departments are sort of desperately making contingency plans. I was reading a report here just last week about JP Morgan Chase, one of the big Wall Street firms, that they have a kind of war room that meets daily to kind of discuss what they might do in the event of a default. So these plans are being put in place, but everyone is hoping they don't have to be activated. The whole world depends on US treasuries. It's the linchpin, if you like, of the global financial system. And if that gets upended, the ripple effects won't just be felt here in America, but around the world equally. And that is the assumption being that suddenly the cost of borrowing could go up everywhere in the world, not just here in America, but where you are and other countries, because all of these financial instruments are based on US Treasury bonds at the kind of heart of it. And if they're not seen as dependable, then the whole kind of pricing mechanism goes up in smoke. And that's where people kind of say, we can't even imagine what that will look like.
That was Michelle Fleury. And later, after the meeting, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, had this to say.
Why are we in such a problem? The expenditures, the amount of money government spends. So on a 50-year average, government normally spends about 21% of GDP. Right now, with 22, after the Democrats took over, they're over 24% of GDP. So the problem is not revenue, the problem is spending. So if you want to know where our differences have been, it's always been the same place. I simply believe like any household, like any business, like any state government. When you're this far out of whack, you have to spend less than you spent last year. That's why we talk about that, going back to where we spent just 5 months ago. Put a cap in there, grow the economy, pull back money that hasn't been spent, like COVID funds that have sat there for 2 years. Who thinks we should do that? Save the taxpayer money. The other thing is, how do we get people back into the workforce?
How would you describe the tone of the conversation tonight between you and the president?
I think the tone tonight was better than any other time we've had discussions. I felt it was productive because, look, we both know, we've walked through this for a long time, where our differences, we're explaining them, we're giving a give and take of what we think would be best for moving the country forward. We still will have some philosophical differences, but I felt it was productive in that manner, in the manner in which we produced, and I think we were able to really focus on the areas of this difference.
The only black Republican member of the United States Senate, Tim Scott, has announced that he will be running for his party's nomination to become their presidential election candidate next year. He joins the former President Donald Trump and the former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in an already crowded Republican field. This report from Gary O'Donoghue in Washington.
I'm announcing today that I'm running for President of the United States of America!
Tim Scott used his launch event to promote a relentlessly optimistic view of America, saying his family had gone from cotton picking to Congress in the space of one lifetime. He said he was living proof that America was the land of opportunity and not the land of oppression, something not all African Americans would agree with. He begins his campaign scarcely making an impression on the polls, but with a substantial amount of money in the bank, which should give him some staying power through the coming months. But it's far from clear that his more moderate message, compared to Donald Trump, is one that will resonate with the Republican base, which seems still enamoured of the former president's more apocalyptic vision.
That was Gary O'Donoghue. Now, as we heard in the earlier podcast, the Spanish football giants Real Madrid have lodged a hate crime complaint after their striker, Vinicius Junior, was racially abused by opposition fans. Sunday's match between Real and Valencia was briefly suspended after the Brazil international, who is black, called for the referee to take action. Vinicius Junior has declared that the Spanish league now belongs to racists. The head of the Spanish Football Federation, Luis Rubiales, acknowledged that the country had a problem with racism.
In our country, we have a problem of behaviour, of education, of racism. Even if it's just one person or a small group of awful people, it's a problem that stains the whole of Spanish football.
So what is being done to tackle the problem? Guilhem Balaguer is a Spanish football journalist.
The battle against discrimination, it's daily and forever. I understand why people would like everything to be sorted by Tuesday, but there are steps taken in the right direction, and I'll tell you which ones they are. Another thing is if it's fast enough, and I'll tell you why it isn't. The steps are quite clear. The law is one of the strongest law, civil law, against hate crime in the whole of Europe. So we've got what we need to actually fine people, punish them. The problem is not so much in La Liga, as Vinicius points out, because La Liga have denounced and filed a complaint to the sports authority every time that Vinicius has been racially abused, or anybody. The problem is that when they take in the next step, which was in the last month or so, taking the case to the prosecutor office as well, that's what La Liga have done in some of these racial abuse cases. Once it gets there, that's the problem. Because most of the time, I'd say 90% of the time, the case gets thrown out of court. Why? Because judges feel that there is not enough evidence. Or it's just a bit of industrial language. Or it's a bit of banter. Or it happens in football and it's not been taken seriously by the judges. Why don't they take it seriously? Because they are influenced by a society that don't consider this a huge problem. So that's where we stand. Society has to change, and football is just a mirror of society, of course.
It's really interesting that you talk about how far such issues pervade society as a whole. Spain, as you say, has these very tough laws, but how much do people within education and within civil society as a whole experience racism or view racism when they see it happening to other people?
It's growing, the amount of people that come from outside Spain, that live in Spain or work in Spain or want to find a life in Spain. But it has happened for long enough now for us to listen to their experiences. And we're not doing that. Yes, it's of course a very visible situation, the one of Vinicius, but I can tell you of players in the second division and in the third tier of Spanish football and fourth tier that are not Spanish or not Spanish looking, if you like, who have suffered abuse. And we're not doing a lot about it, even though files have been put in the right places. Another way for those people that suffer racism to actually influence the debate is to be in decision-making roles. They're not. It's institutional racism, what's happening in Spain. So how do you change that? Just apply the laws, make the judges change their mind about what's going on. But it won't be resolved this month or next year. It is a battle, as you know full well, for instance, in the UK. It's a battle that's daily and it's forever. There is no stopping the racism thinking, especially when you see that in Parliament, in the Spanish Parliament, you've got a far-right racist political party who is growing in influence.
That was the Spanish football journalist Guilhem Balaguer. Still to come.
It's a steady drop, and when it's combined with a steady sea level rise, it's going to get serious.
New York City is gradually sinking, but what difference are its skyscrapers making?
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the 2011 disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant.
There is no greater threat we face at this time than the one unfolding in Fukushima Daiichi.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Nigel Ng is a Malaysian comedian and he's had his social media accounts blocked by China just days after he shared a promotional video on an upcoming show which included jokes that were critical of Beijing. The freezing of his accounts over the weekend is also believed to be a reaction to the stand-up show's release date, which coincides with the anniversary of the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown, a highly sensitive event for the Chinese authorities. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told us more about him.
He's called Nigel Ng, but he goes under the performing name of Uncle Roger, essentially a middle-aged Malaysian gentleman giving his views on life. The comedian's actually made a name for himself in Britain and is London-based, but he's got an appeal quite across a wide area, which is why he's got involved with the Chinese authorities, because he has a Weibo account in China which has 400,000 followers. He is actually ethnically Chinese, so that's the appeal there. Actually, he gained a real name for himself a few years ago because of a criticism of a BBC video, actually, where someone was trying to do fried rice and he actually just panned it and said, look, that's not the way to cook fried rice. So giving the Asian view on lots of issues.
Why is he now controversial? What did he allegedly do?
Well, in the next couple of weeks, he's going to release a kind of long piece of stand-up. But last week, he released a short trailer for that video in which he talked quite a lot about China. Now, China's very sensitive about its image. Its leaders are very sensitive about how they are portrayed, particularly in humour. And so in this clip, Uncle Roger has an exchange with somebody in the audience who he finds out is from China.
You're from Boston?
Originally from Guangzhou.
Guangzhou, China.
Yeah.
China, okay. China, good country. Good country. Good country. We have to say that now, correct? Oh, their phone listening. Oh, their phone listening.
A second clip, he talks about Taiwan, a really sensitive subject in China because China believes it's part of its own territory and doesn't want any suggestion that it's an independent country.
A niece and nephew from Taiwan? Not a real country. Not a real... Not a real country. I hope one day you rejoin the motherland, one China.
And as you say, this isn't the first time that Chinese leaders have shown their sensitivity to the way that they and their country are portrayed.
Exactly. Censorship in China is not just about serious political issues. It's about all kinds of image-related material, including humour. Just last week, for example, a comic in China was arrested and his company fined because they'd made some joke which appeared to refer to a saying popularised by the leader Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping, by the way, for many years has been characterised by his critics as looking like Winnie the Pooh, and so all references to Winnie the Pooh in China have been expunged from the internet. So really, really sensitive, and sometimes it gets a little bit silly, but it really just gives you the idea of how desperate Chinese leaders are to control how they are viewed, not just to their own people, but across the world.
That was Michael Bristow. Buckingham Palace has said that it's unlikely to allow the exhumation of the remains of a 19th century Ethiopian prince, despite pressure for them to be returned to his native country. Prince Alamea, the son of one of the country's most prominent rulers, was brought to the UK when he was just seven after British forces stormed his father's palace. His descendants are now asking King Charles to return his remains, which are buried at Windsor Castle. The BBC's Kalkidanya Baltal has the story.
In northern Ethiopia, home to ancient churches and historic castles, the family of a prince are waiting for his return. In the 19th century, Alamayo's father, Emperor Theodros II, took hostage a number of British missionaries and diplomats. The force that was sent to rescue them defeated his army and he killed himself. His mountain citadel was destroyed and looted. Alongside many priceless treasures, the British also took the 7-year-old prince back to London. His life was short and tragic, dying before his 20th birthday. Queen Victoria arranged for him to be buried in Windsor Castle. Now his relatives hope King Charles will agree to have the young prince's remains sent home. Fasil Minas is Alamayo's great-great-grand-cousin.
We want his remains back as a family and as Ethiopians. The fact that he was buried there is meaningless, and it was not right.
But in a statement to the BBC, Buckingham Palace said exhuming Alamayo's remains was unlikely, as it would disturb others buried nearby. There are growing calls across Africa for the wrongs of the colonial era to be put right. Dr. Alula Pankhurst is a member of the Ethiopian Heritage Restitution Committee.
Restitution is used as a way to bring reconciliation, to recognize what was wrong in the past, but to go beyond that and to create, forge bridges and links and collaborations.
Reburials are common in Ethiopia. Emperor Theodos II's remains were moved to his home village many years after his death. His family hope he will one day be joined by his son.
That report by Kalkidan Yebaltal in Ethiopia. New York City is sinking a couple of millimetres a year. Nothing new in that. But what is new is that scientists are warning that the city is sinking in part because of the extraordinary weight of its vertiginous buildings. Tom Parsons is a geophysicist at the US Geological Survey and led the study about New York. Evan Davis asked him if anybody had ever thought that tall buildings could raise sea levels.
Maybe not in that context, but certainly when a building is built, the engineers and the architects understand that it's going to settle, which is what they call it, when it's sinking. So we know about that. I guess this might be the first time where we looked at the collective weight of all of them at once.
So just talk to us about how serious the issue facing New York is, Manhattan in particular.
It's sort of time dependent. Right now, it's not terribly serious. So there have been some hurricanes that have forced their way into the city and caused some severe flooding. But it's a steady drop. And when it's combined with a steady sea level rise, it's going to get serious.
So, I mean, 2 millimetres a year is, I think, the figure that your study came up with. Just, is that a lot? I mean, that's a centimetre every 5 years. Is it going to carry on at that rate? Because you could probably live with that.
Yeah, it's going to carry on pretty steadily. The other side of the equation, as I mentioned, is sea level rise, right, which we mostly expect to accelerate depending on what we do around the climate. So that's when you combine the two together and you project out, say, to 2050 or so, we're looking at a fairly significant amount of subsidence combined with sea level rise.
That was Tom Parsons, a geophysicist at the US Geological Survey. A capsule carrying the crew, which includes Saudi Arabia's first woman in space, has docked with the International Space Station. Rayana Barnawi will conduct 20 experiments focusing on stem cell and breast cancer research. After arriving at the ISS, she said the mission showed what could be achieved with global cooperation.
Greetings from outer space. I'm here not only representing myself, but representing the hopes and dreams of everyone back home, everyone in the region. We are here gathering with different cultures and this international collaboration. This shows how space brings everyone together.
This recent space flight to the International Space Station, which is in orbit above the Earth, took around 16 hours. Mike Thompson has more details on the crew.
This truly international space mission blasted off from Florida on Sunday. Saudi Arabia's first woman in space is accompanied by fellow Saudi Ali Al-Khani, a fighter pilot. Also on board are American businessman John Schaffner and mission commander Peggy Whitson. The four are joining the seven astronauts, three Russians, three Americans and an Emirati already inside the space station. They're due to spend around 10 days on board the orbiting laboratory in a mission organised by Axiom Space.
Mike Thompson. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, some good news. Well, I think it's good news. After the last Christmas Happy Pod, people told us they wanted more positivity in their lives. So our glorious leader, Karen, persuaded important people higher up than us to let us try a pilot. And to cut a long story short, it worked. So that means we are going to make it a regular thing. The launch date is June the 10th, and we would love you to be involved. So send us the sound of the thing that gives you joy, as out there as you like. Email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alana Bowles. A producer was Liam McSheffrey. And as you already know, our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
In March 2011, Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant was struck by a massive earthquake.
Stay down! Get under our desk if you can! Cover your head and stay down!
An hour later, a tsunami followed in its wake, flooding its basements, cutting the power, turning the stricken plant into a ticking time bomb.
It's all underwater.
Station blackout. Reactor control systems have lost all power.
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of those fighting to contain the disaster and of those living with its legacy.
Why do you seek forgiveness?
I'm the one whose job it was to make sure the disaster couldn't happen.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.